You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, this is The Review, a podcast from The Atlantic's culture team about movies, television, and all the things we make to entertain ourselves. I'm Sophie Gilbert, a staff writer at The Atlantic, and I'm joined today by two other staff writers on our culture team, Spencer Kornhaber.
Hello.
Hi, Spencer, and Shirley Lee.
Hi.
Today, we're talking about Apple TV's Dickinson, now on its third and final season. The show is a reimagining of the reclusive poet Emily Dickinson's life in the 19th century. But it's not a period drama or a pure biopic. I think I described it once as a bonkers Gen Z fever dream. Wait, I can't
you
remember
did.
If that quote is me. Did I?
Oh, hold on. You did. I think it's an excellent way to describe it, Sophie.
Rather than period drama or pure biopic, it plays as a kind of bonkers Gen Z fever dream, as in it has a modern soundtrack, the dialogue is full of anachronistic 21st century slang, characters might say they're hella stoked about the railroad coming to Amherst, or that they're staying in for, quote, novels and chill. It's an unusual show. I remember when it was first announced, we were all a bit like, okay. It just sounded like, I mean, do you remember when it was announced as one of the leads in Apple's new slate and we were all a bit
we were completely
perturbed.
Yeah. Right? There's no way.
Yeah. I definitely tweeted something that was like, Mad Libs TV strikes again. Actress is going to star as historical figure in confusing premise on
there was,
streaming service you hadn't heard of.
Or it was like Stefan from SNL being like, the hottest new TV show has Emily Dickinson played by Hailee Steinfeld and blah, blah, blah. Like it was very that energy.
Yeah. Well, it's funny too, because its creator, Elena Smith, who was a playwright and then wrote for shows including The Affair and The Newsroom before she made Dickinson, she had a Twitter account that was Tween Hobo. It was a parody of tweens who would ride around America, playing guitar. And so it does have that atmosphere, right, where it's like very online. And yet, when I saw the first episodes and as it's gone on, it works. And so we had to talk today about why it works, also about Emily Dickinson's relationship with The Atlantic, which features in season 3 in a fun way. But I wanted to ask you guys first, Shirley, tell me, are you a fan of the show? How do you feel about it?
Well,
how did it surprise you?
I am a huge fan of using M dashes to the consternation of my editors. So I am indeed a fan of Emily Dickinson and therefore a fan of the show.
We're doing the thing that Dickinsons do, which is to stay at home and sit very quietly with our own thoughts.
What she said. A quiet night in, baby. Novels and chill.
When the show first came out, I was not sure what to expect. I had, along with the rest of the internet, cracked those jokes about it being basically like a Weekend Update Stefan bit. This show has everything.
Wiz Khalifa in a carriage as John Mulaney as Henry David Thoreau and his mom is bringing him lunch.
Jason Mantzoukas as a bee.
As a bee.
Yes, Jason Mantzoukas as a bee.
High on Opium.
Billie Eilish and Mitski in the soundtrack. Like, sure. And so I went in there like really not sure what to expect. And then the next thing I knew, I binged all of the screeners, like in one night. I just couldn't stop watching. So I became a fan really quickly, but I didn't watch it the way it was intended to be watched, I think.
It's so
and it's only over time that I, yeah.
It's so interesting that you said that, because I really agree. Like, I think this is a show that needs to be binged, and the release model is not helping. And I think one of the reasons is you really want to stay in its mood once you're kind of in that space where you're open to it and you're receptive to the characters, because it's not a show where a ton happens, right? Like, there's not an enormous amount of plot. There's lots of character-driven studies, and there's poetry. Every episode is based around an Emily Dickinson poem, I should say. And Shelley, you talked last week in our Spencer podcast about how Spencer is less an accurate biopic or a real historical portrait of Princess Diana than a soul study. And I actually thought that was such a good way of describing Dickinson too. It's less a story about Emily Dickinson, even though very much within the show is based on historical fact, than it is a kind of attempt to imagine the person who wrote these poems, particularly sort of reimagined a little bit within our own temporal context. Does that make sense to you guys?
Absolutely.
It does. This is going to show where I feel like I'm like, does that make sense? Am I reading
this? It's a hard show to describe. That's why, like, none of us were really sold on it when it was first, you know, put out into the world just as a press release.
Yeah. I mean, that's such an interesting way of thinking about it. That is a show that you have to binge. Like, when we say that, usually it's like, you say that because the plot is so good, but you're right. It's not like a super propulsive story. You kind of like can go on Wikipedia and find out basically what happens in her life. And we kind of all know what happens in America in her time period. But what keeps you going is just sort of like, you don't want the trip to end. Because there have been times when I put on an episode and I'm like, what am I watching? I don't want to watch. Like, this is not working for me right now. Like, the vibes are off. But when the vibes are good, like, yeah, I'm all in on it.
Yeah, it's a vibes show.
The vibes in this place are off.
I think it's still haunted from the seance. Emily literally saw a ghost.
Every episode is centered around a poem, but it is just kind of getting the vibes of the poem and of its atmosphere and trying to drive home the point that Emily Dickinson, the way we've learned about her, has always been kind of different from who she perhaps really was, because she didn't really fit into her society all that well. So recasting her as this like millennial voice enhances that contrast, the way she didn't quite fit into this stuffy 19th century life. But then what's fascinating about the show is that the premise just keeps layering on more of this conceptual, like, again, capital V vibe. And the only thing that's really keeping it grounded is like the painstaking detail in recreating 19th century Amherst, like down to the costumes and the sets.
Anyway, it's very Jeffersonian. So Jeffersonian.
I wanted to talk about other shows in this mode. I think when season two of Dickinson came out, the New York Times review said it sometimes edges painfully close to Drunk History or something like that. But it does at times have that vibe. And I think Jane Krakowski, who plays Emily's mother, sometimes she is amazing in the show. She's extremely entertaining. And I didn't fully appreciate her until I read a letter that Emily wrote to Thomas Wentworth Higginson, where
our former colleague
at The Atlantic. And she said, I think she had one biting quote about her mother, and it was, "My mother does not care for thought."
That's so cold. Your poor mom.
It reminds me, I don't know if I should put this in context, but it reminds me so much of "He appears not to read." "My mother does not care for thought."
Jane Krakowski is so good in capturing the essence of that one burn.
"Unlike you, I am not in the habit of constantly expressing myself."
Spencer, I wanted to ask you, is that the vibe that sometimes puts you off, where you're not in the mood for it, but is it throwing to you at all?
Yeah, I mean, sometimes a show wants to create a reaction, and you can kind of see its gears of zaniness turning, and it's just a little slapstick or over the top in a way that sometimes really connects with me, and sometimes I'm like, you are just doing this to create the GIFs, or you're just doing this to be turned into a meme, or to have a little think piece written about you. Like, it's such a modern show and such an internet era show, even though it's obviously not set in the internet times, but it's playing with the kind of like very fractured attention seeking mentality of content and discourse in our era.
In this information boom, it's all about the eyeballs. We need as many as possible glued to our pages for as long as possible. It's an attention economy.
But it's interesting to think about that in relation to Emily Dickinson, who seemed pretty uninterested in her life in really getting any sort of notoriety or fame.
Maybe I shouldn't try to have an audience at all. Maybe fame is dangerous.
There are times when they'll be twerking or swearing a lot or having sex scenes in the orchard. I'm just like, this is taking me out of it and in its extremity. But in general, what is so great about it is the way it's kind of like is a collage between these different moments and the way it does kind of like ape the qualities of poetry, really. Like it's more about like moving you with feeling and sensation than about story.
So Spencer's a prude.
No. But I love Jane Krakowski's mom character. Like, we can get into like the gender dynamics of this show and its kind of commentary, but she is this poor woman who has dedicated herself to the arts of being a housewife and really believes in that her identity and her purpose on earth is to be the ultimate housewife.
Edward, you seem to forget you've married the best housewife in all of New England. I can host two tea parties with my eyes closed and one hand tied behind my back.
She is so giving and so loving to her family, but it like verges on mania when you have someone like your modern daughter who doesn't want to do it and doesn't want to exist in your mold. It really blows her mind. Like the idea that like women could be wanting to do anything other than getting water from the well at 4 a.m.
Yeah, that's a pretty classic plot line, I think, the mother-daughter feuding.
Mother's trying to disown me again.
I was married at 18, Emily. It's high time for you to get a husband.
I wanted to ask you about Dickinson the poet. I, like many 12-year-old girls, fell in love with the poems of Emily Dickinson when I was a 12-year-old girl. And I think one of the reasons is because she just has that intensity of feeling in her poetry. Like, and when you're 12, you feel everything so intensely, you know, you're like, oh, boys exist and I don't know any. And, you know, everything is sort of, well, maybe you guys didn't write poems when you were 12, but I did. And I feel like they all had this kind of like this idea of like life is out there, but I don't have it, but I feel it. Do you know what I mean? And I feel like one of the things that made me so confused about this show was also knowing as little as I did about Emily Dickinson at the time, this sort of wondering how it would marry her poetry with the reality of her life, which was, you know, what I knew, which was that she was pretty reclusive. She was born in 1830 in Amherst. And I think around about the time she was 36, 37, she began basically staying in her room to the point where even for her father's funeral in 1874, she stayed in her room. They had it in the hallway downstairs. And I think she cracked the door open so she could hear it.
Well, she's been doing this more and more these days, hiding like some mad woman in an attic. It's really quite unsettling. I do hope it's just a phase.
She just sort of isolated herself at that point. And I was like, how are you going to make a show about a woman who stayed in her room? That doesn't sound super scintillating. But I love what they've done with Emily, the character. I love Hayley Steinfeld's performance. I think Hayley is so charming.
She really is.
Especially as this character. And the one thing that the show really centers around is her relationship with Susan Gilbert, no relation, who married Emily's brother, Austin.
We're engaged. Sue Gilbert is to become Sue Dickinson.
Congratulations.
It's made me more aware of how in real life historians are starting to understand that Emily actually did have this relationship with Susan, that it was passionate and it was erased from the historical record by Austin's mistress. I know. Yes. Is this going to be in the show?
So you say it's like her life didn't seem all that scintillating. Yeah, you know what? It's actually soap operatic.
Yeah, it really is. Literally erased Susan's name from Emily's letters. It's so amazing. Shelley, did you love Emily Dickinson's poems when you were a 12-year-old girl?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think, much like you, Soph, I also felt very deeply, didn't quite know how to express myself. And I think the way that her poems, again, back to the M-dashes, never quite finished thoughts, I still do this. I just, I think, ended a sentence midway through. Like, she feels so passionately that she has to keep on going. And often her use of M dashes and Old English and capitalizing nouns First of all, the whole capitalizing nouns thing in certain words is already a very online thing.
Yeah.
So Dickinson was certainly ahead of her time. But it is also, it just, it's resonant because that is the way you would feel as a, like, as a young girl reading in class Emily Dickinson's poems, just being like, wow, she thinks the way that I think, not to say that I am anywhere near that level of genius. It's just the emotion. It's the passion of it. So I wholeheartedly agree. But also, you know, again, speaking to erasure, in class, we definitely never talked about Sue. We never talked about Emily's mm-hmm. private life, aside from the fact that she was very private. It's just American female poet, reclusive. All right, here are the poems. <You know? laughs>
No, I love that. It's like when I used to write in my diary, I used to underline things once, twice, and then three yes. times when they were like really important. And I feel like Emily's capitalization has a similar effect. Mm-hmm. Spencer, I don't want to hazard a guess about what you were passionate about when you were 12, but...
I was writing like the lyrics to rock songs on my binder.
I was going to say,
like in really interesting swirling sort of designs. You they weren't my lyrics. I wasn't... Yeah. No, I was also posting on message boards. And if anyone,
I might have encountered you on a message board. Who knows?
That was my creative outlet. Yeah.
But I did want to ask you about the show's use of music. How you yes. think it works? How you think it doesn't? Does it take you out of the show? Does it enhance the mood? Like, what do you make of the curation?
Yeah, I mean, their use of music is absolutely wild. They love to slam in a raunchy rap song in the middle of a pastoral mm-hmm. scene, or they'll have Billie Eilish playing when she's in the back of Death's coach, or they'll have like indie rock song like Mitski playing during a sex scene. These are all contemporary references, obviously, mm-hmm. and they're cool, right? Like they give a sense that the people who are creating the show aren't just like picking... you know, like the way that some Netflix shows might kind of just like use music as a placeholder or an emotionally manipulative tool. Like the music they're picking like has a lot of like cultural connotations. Always. It's like it really brings you into the present. The present being, you know, 2019, 2020, 2021. I was reading an interview with the creator, I believe, or maybe the music supervisor, and they were saying they picked the music to be modern and specifically avoided any music from like the 90s, the 80s. You know, you could imagine yes. like a rock and roll Dickinson show, or like you could imagine, yeah, like something like a synth pop song from the 80s coming in. But they consciously avoid that because they really want to create a very specific dialogue between her era and our era. And so, you know, I appreciate that like as a viewer right now. And it makes me wonder like how will this show play if people go back to it in 5, 10, 20 years. Like is it like weirdly dating the show that didn't need to be dated.
Yeah.
But I kind of like that they're putting a stake in the ground and saying, this is a show about a time period, and the time period is now, this particular stretch of time that we're living in, this very second.
That's how the creator has consistently described it, right? Like this, she wants this show to hold up a mirror to our present, our exact present. So it's not going to use music from any other decade. The terminology is going to be hyper specific. Like on a recent episode, there's a character who spells out what tea means.
Tea? Oh, I didn't know you wanted some. Girls, go make some tea.
No, I mean like the tea, the gossip.
One thing you do when you incorporate a lot of very online elements is you run the risk of almost seeming like you're trivializing the story. And maybe I should check myself in saying that, but do I see Gen Zs as trivial? No, I don't think I do.
Are we talking about the show as a Gen Z show or millennial show, or do we think they're the same things?
Oh dear, oh dear, oh dear.
Because like, we've gone back and forth here, and I think
I feel like we should just shut this bottle right now. I mean, because people get
one of the great questions of our ages.
Why would you
like,
release
people
this
get
genius,
very
Spencer?
Passionate about generational lines, and I'm afraid to. yelled at before.
I mean, here's the thing: defining generations is kind of bullshit in the first place, right?
Right.
Like we ran a piece recently about this. I think this is trafficking in very blurred line territory. Yeah.
but the thing I wanted to say is that you do run the risk of, I think, trivializing a story. And I think Dickinson does have sort of serious intent underneath its, you know, I don't know, fetish wear corset. That's a bad example. But I think, like, Elena Smith, like you were saying, Shirley, has yeah. talked about the show as exploring the idea of the living past.
Yes.
And she's also sort of mentioned, you know, the show being about the gothic experience of being a woman, which is mm-hmm. why there are these sort of gothic elements. And Emily feels so trapped and stifled. And the real life Emily Dickinson, I think, barely had books in her house because her father was, you know, very disapproving of
her father, a Whig.
Well, her father said her father bought her books, but told her not to read them.
Right.
It's my very mixed messaging. They jumbled the mind or joggled the mind, she wrote.
Joggled the mind. Such a good quote. That was a quote from Emily Dickinson's letter to Thomas Wentworth Higginson. Hang on, I did write that down. What does it say? He buys me many books, but begs me not to read them because he fears they joggle the mind.
They do joggle the mind.
We stand an icon.
They do joggle the mind.
It's a correct fear, but, you know, we need to be joggled.
My father buys me books and begs me not to read them. He fears they joggle the mind.
Bit of a mixed message.
But I wanted to talk about this approach in terms of modernizing period stories, because Dickinson is by mm-hmm. no means alone. We also have seen recently Bridgerton on Netflix and The Great on Hulu. And Shirley, you've written about both of those shows. So what do you mm-hmm. make of this trend? Does it work in your mind? What is it trying to do?
Well, I think we as a culture have been doing these retrospectives, right? Like, people have been writing about this recently where we keep, like, going back to certain pop stars. Britney Spears is a great example, and reevaluating their place in our larger, you know, celebrity worship culture, and whether yeah. we were unfair, and et cetera, et cetera. And I do think these shows fit into that bubble as well, where we want to reassess historical figures. We want to reassess our understanding of them. And I think, though, this isn't so recent that it's like a completely new genre by any means. You know, Sofia Coppola's Marie Antoinette came out 15 years ago, I believe. And even before that, you know, you have movies like A Knight's Tale, which also does a lot of anachronistic things. So these tricks have been used before. I think the reason why we're seeing all this experimentation in the form of shows like Dickinson, The Great, and Bridgerton, we've had a lot more creatives who want to say something more about women and creativity and sexuality and all these really potent themes. There is something in the water. And I don't want to attribute everything to 2016, but I do think that you had a lot of showrunners who started thinking about gender, politics, and race, and privilege, and to do that, sometimes couching it in a modern story doesn't quite deliver the message. And one of the strongest messages is to show how history repeats itself.
The Know-Nothings have built a platform on populist economic rhetoric and anti-immigrant nativist anxiety. It's a heady brew.
Noxious, yes,
but it's working.
What do you mean people are actually voting for these clowns?
Indeed.
Bring up 2016, that occurred to me too. We're talking about Donald Trump's election here.
what? No.
But like, what that did was knock everyone into feeling like we're living in history again. Like, mm-hmm. you know, certain moments in our lives were very woken up to this feeling like we're part of this very, very long story. And we make comparisons between our time and the wars mm-hmm. that we've read about, or, you know, whatever historical events we've kind of always thought of as kind of hazy and far off. You start to think of what it actually feel like to live through that. And so I think we've been thinking a lot about that. And I think we're kind of also interested in the idea that people who were living through history were just like us. Like that is, you know, it's a fascinating idea, and it's sort of a comforting idea. And it's sort of like a scary mm-hmm. idea too, that,
not much has changed.
Not like the way that the world felt wasn't different. Like they and Dickinson were living through the Civil War, and, you know, all these young men were dying, and that's what season 3 is largely about, it appears mm-hmm. so far. And it's very explicit drawing a connection between how it feels to live through that and how it feels to live through the pandemic, where, you know, these kids in their, or these people, young Americans in their 20s are like, ugh, this is ruining my 20s. Civil War ruins everything.
I wanted to talk about the show's portrayal of race, because it's very specific. It's very intentional. Mm-hmm. I think I think it does a really good job of telling a story about 19th century America that is accurate to what was happening in America at that time. As in, it's not just about the white characters who Emily Dickinson might have occasionally met in her living room before she went up to her bedroom and never came out. But it's also about the black characters around her. Henry, who's an abolitionist and the editor of the Constellation.
Yes.
Which is an abolitionist newspaper. And Betty, who is a local dressmaker. And I wanted to ask you guys what you thought about how the show portrays race.
Well, first, I find this series to be really specific about its portrayal of race, and it's different from The Great by not approaching colorblind casting. Dickinson very deliberately casts its white characters in history as white, black characters in its history as black, while also incorporating, you know, characters of color who were part of historical record. Like, the Japanese character on the show is supposed to represent an actual Japanese man who graduated college and it was maybe part of the social circle. So there's elements of that. What I find fascinating about Dickinson when it tackles race is it does all of this because it really wants this thread of authenticity to be the one authentic element to the rest of its, like, heady conceptual understanding of time and modernity. You know, everything else, I've seen this comparison somewhere else, so it's, do not credit this to me. Everything else about Dickinson does feel a little bit like when an English teacher is like, well, to understand this novel, why don't you create a rap about it? You know, like you get it now in a modern context, right? If we Hamiltonize it. But it's casting of black characters, its rendering of their plot is really, really trying to be historically faithful.
I mean, it's definitely going out of its way to give storylines to black characters. But I think you feel the show trying to pull out and be like, no, we're not just a show about Emily Dickinson. We're a show about America in this time period and America now.
Yeah.
And right. So like, and the that's the license it gives itself to kind of swoop in and not only have white characters be driving the action, you know. And I think it is interesting to watch the show place these characters in a time when they were thinking about race all the time. You know, the Civil War was brewing and then it broke out, and they actually do like talk about slavery over the dinner table all the time. Like every episode, it's basically in there in one way or another.
Jane, you're like so woke.
I know.
If I was allowed to vote, I would vote Republican.
Good for you.
The Republicans are the only ones who explicitly stand against slavery, the true progressives. They're on the right side of history.
You know, all the characters do end up talking about the Civil War. And it's funny that the way they talk about the Civil War and about race uses the modern parlance that we use. And so a lot of conversations end up in this region of where nobody really knows how to talk about race.
I mean, in this new season, there's Thomas Wentworth Higginson, who, you know, is our, as we said, our Atlantic colleague from way back. And he's, you know, he's kind of the enlightened, white, woke bro. And it's sort of cringe to watch him
talk
about,
to watch.
You know,
it's
like,
terrible.
He's gone to his DEI sessions and all that. And he's trying to be a good, you know, white guy in the 1800s.
I must prove to all the, let's call them skeptics, that these men are as brave, as disciplined and as learned as any white soldiers.
I see.
Damn it!
There I go, centering whiteness again.
Excuse me?
In his meeting with Henry, he just like spouts all of these words that he's probably heard in all of his DEI classes. And at the end of it, when Henry doesn't like embrace him fully as a quote-unquote brother, as he keeps saying, he just goes, I'll do better. Like, which is such
doing
a great
the work,
punchline.
You know, we can all just do the work.
Yeah, it's just such a good punchline.
But also, he never stops talking, which is...
Yes.
Right.
I'm really trying to police my language here. Ah, not police. Patrol. No, that's problematic as well. Damn! I'll do better.
Yeah, that episode is fantastic.
Yeah, that was really one of my favorites. I think it's an example of how the show's tricky tonal balance actually really works. And it might not. It's risky because you're telling a story about the Civil War. Like, the show is set against the backdrop of the Civil War. And so there's no way to do that without really exploring what the Civil War was about. You know, you run the risk with a show like Dickinson of making it all about a bunch of rich white people mourning people who've gone off to fight and sort of not thinking about the narrative in a slightly more fully rounded way. So you have this portrayal that is rich and complex and trying to be serious, but then you have this parody of Thomas Wentworth Higginson that could kind of counterbalance it all, but doesn't, because and I think that's what the show does so well, honestly. It does manage that tone, at least to me. Where you have these sort of absurd moments of like modern parlance, but you also understand that there is a serious story beneath it.
Yeah. I wonder what really keeps it from teetering over the edge, because it can go so absurdist. You know, again, J.C. Mantzoukas' bee hallucination. well, like, I remember seeing that and being like, boy, this show is just wilding out. Like,
well, it's a show about the life of the mind. Like, it's a show about interiority, and we all know how screwed up it can get in there. So, you know, when it takes, when it has the bee, I think it's you know, doing what poets do, which is be like, put out this really like bizarre way of seeing the world and trusting that the viewer will relate, because we all have seen the Jason Mantzoukas bee.
Spencer, are you saying that the show takes takes poetic license?
I've never heard of that, actually.
That's so poetic.
Yes, because it's a poem.
It's absurdist, but there's a grain of truth within the craziness, right? Which I'm thinking about Zosia Mamet's portrayal of Louisa May Alcott, you know, and she's like, I just want to write a book and make bank. I'm paraphrasing. But but it's true. Like, Louisa May Alcott did write Little Women and compromise her artistic standards for money. She wanted money. She didn't want to marry Joe and Laurie. She did that because her publisher made her, and the book was wildly successful.
Oh, yeah. I'm just trying to get paid. You know, I'm just about that hustle, so...
It is funny, and the portrayals are great, and they are ridiculous, but there's a grain of truth within it, and I think that, again, is what the show does well. I think one of my favorites from season two is Timothy Simons of Veep fame, playing Frederick Law Olmsted, the landscape architect and designer of Central Park. It was a funny moment, but it was also touching. He really did impart something to Emily that I think was important to her in that scene about sort of pursuing her passions.
The audience is irrelevant. The work itself is the gift, not the praise for it. Understand that, and you'll understand true mastery.
Yeah, and taking on sort of that position so far in this season, I really liked Billy Eichner's take on Walt Whitman, you know, wasn't really veering outside of Billy Eichner's usual, like, shoutiness, but it fit what the show was trying to do with Walt Whitman.
I like that all the, there's this kind of... tradition in the show of doing wild guest casting for the other literary celebrities of the time, and they're all completely bonkers. They're like completely over the top characters, and the most over the top characters in the show other than Emily. And it's like, these artists in their time were just not normal. They're just like truly weirdos, and that is like the kind of class of person we're talking about.
You're uncomfortably denigrating the founders of our magazines.
I know, this when The Atlantic came up this season, it was like, here we go.
No good can come of this.
What do you want to read?
I don't know. Emerson
is canceled.
Oh, okay.
I mean, this did send me down an Atlantic Archives rabbit hole, and we really do have the goods on her, so props to us. Though I guess we failed to publish her poems in her lifetime. Oops.
Yeah, she didn't publish any books. I think she published 10 out of 1,800. Mm-hmm. Well, there is that amazing piece that Thomas Wentworth Higginson wrote about her after her death, when he revealed that, I guess, she was one of those artists who people became just crazy about after she died. And he wrote, I think, that the passion really surprised even him. And because no one knew anything about her, she was really this great mystery. People were starving. There was no... What's that gossip Instagram?
Demois
back then. So they were just begging Thomas Wentworth Higginson for details of her life. And he spilled the tea, as the show would say. He also revealed that she once signed a letter to him, "Your gnome."
Yes.
G-N-O-M-E, which I found perplexing.
Yeah, reading those letters, you're just like, oh, this show is maybe not going far enough.
Yes.
She was hilarious and just like screwing with him.
Like the creator of the show, like Elena Smith has said that she worked on this show because she was obsessed with Emily Dickinson. And she spent like 10 years developing this show. I read an interview with her where she did just talk about how the one question that kept knocking around her mind was, how did this privileged New England woman become this rocket ship of passion who was doing things with language that no one had done before or has ever done since? And there's like almost no way to answer it. So then you're just like, well, here's a Billie Eilish track to try to draw what was happening in this woman's prescient, like, ignited brain.
Wild nights. Wild nights. Where I with thee, wild nights should be our luxury.
Along those lines, I wanted to ask you both how you feel the love affair between Emily and Sue plays in the show. And my read from it is that you sort of forget, again, it's this perfect marriage of our time and the historical moment, because it just feels like such a natural relationship. There's no sense that it's taboo or that they have anything to fear, and, you know, and keeping it secret. It's just this like very, very passionate, loving relationship that also has its problems, as any relationship does. And I was curious for both your reading it. Spencer, what did you think?
Yeah, I mean, I love that they have made Emily Dickinson openly queer, and like, because that does appear to be what the history is, and they really dramatize the amount of passion that she felt for Sue. What I don't get is what's so great about Sue? Like, Sue's not that, like, do you guys like Sue in the show?
Spencer, like, she's so pretty.
She is pretty. Yeah. And there's not a lot to, what I like about her is that her whole family died, and she's so stoked about it. I mean, it's like, I'm sorry, that's like a very terrible way to put it, but the show kind of plays it as a very dark joke that the Dickinsons aren't that nice to her, even though her entire family has died. And that's the most we get about the character, though.
Mm-hmm. And Jane Krakowski's like, makes a joke about dying in childbirth. And Emily's like, Sue's mother died in childbirth.
Sue will be having this baby au naturel, won't you, Sue?
I'm in quite a lot of pain.
Oh, good. The pain is how you know you're still alive.
Ma, don't say that. You know Sue's mother died in childbirth.
Did she?
I'm like, oh, should we laugh at this?
I also, maybe across the first season, I was like, what's so great about this Sue girl? All right, she's pretty. I know, I can absolutely tell that you as an Emily, feel deeply for her. But also, is it just because she's kind of unreachable? She's going to marry your brother. Mm-hmm. One of the many problems in this relationship. But I think as I continued watching the series and thinking about it over time, like, I think maybe Sue is supposed to be not just the person from history, but a representation of who Emily could have been if she took the more traditional route of getting married and having babies. Yeah, it's like in season two, she's the one who keeps like trying to push Emily to publish her poems, right? Where it's like, women can have it all. Go do it. Become known as a poet. I don't know. Like,
it's interesting that you say that because my understanding of the real Sue is that, unlike the Sue in the show, she actually was a writer herself. Whereas the show makes the very conscious decision to have Sue be not really artistic at all. Like, I think in season two, she wants to be an influencer, and she's like, I'm going to host the best soiree.
We need to step up our game. I can't be outdone by a salon in Western Massachusetts.
But she really is kind of, like, basic.
Yeah, you're right.
And so it's making me think that's intentional now that you've made these very smart points, Joe.
No, I think surely you've got it. It is like Emily's constantly tussling with this expectation that she gets settled down and be a good New England housewife. And here's the person who did that, but isn't happy.
Yeah.
I pushed you towards him because I wanted to escape what I was feeling. There is so much that I don't want to feel.
While we're talking about characters, I wanted to give praise for Lavinia, played by Anna Breshnikov, who is Emily's sister, who is just absolutely delightful. And the word I'm thinking of is dizzy, but that's not fair. But she seems to be spinning a lot. She's just so wonderful to watch, and Anna Breshnikov is so funny and engaging.
Come on, it'll be charming. You'll be a Southern belle.
I am a shrewd Yankee witch. Respect that.
I mean, I would also shout out Anna Baryshnikov.
Yeah.
I love the peanut gallery of their friends.
Oh my gosh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Who's led by, like, I think, like, Jane, the popular girl in Amherst, and her little minions.
This is Jane Humphrey we're talking about.
There's a scene with them just commenting on the gossip of the town and how weird Emily is. And whenever Jane mentions that she's a widow.
Freedom is about being yourself, even if you're just a young, hot widow.
All of that just, you know, underlines further what the show is trying to do. But it's just so funny. Every time they're on screen, I love them.
Yeah.
Yeah. Among the minions, Toshiaki is a standout. Clearly queer quoted. Is he the Regina George? Maybe he's the Gretchen Wieners.
He's the Gretchen Wieners.
He's the Gretchen Wieners.
Definitely, he's one of the mean girls. Yeah, any scene with him is hilarious.
Okay, I live for the hot goss I get at these sewing circles.
I know I kind of derisively mentioned the twerking earlier. The scene where they are on opium and twerking, you know, eating crumpets in their ballroom gowns. That is, you know, it's a trick that you've seen a lot in these kind of anachronistic shows, but it was just pure joy.
Yeah.
It's funny, like, just going all the way back to what you were saying earlier, Sophie, this is a show where it's like, yeah, when you binge it, you can really stay in the mood, and it almost, like, it wants you to stay there, and it wants you to continue dreaming / hallucinating with it. Whereas, like, Bridgerton, I didn't binge because I was kind of, well, it's an hour-long show, first of all, and it's a very different story. And you need, like, a breather in between the sexiness. And then the Great is so, I love the Great, but it is also so much crasser and lewder.
It's kind of a nasty show, the Great. Like,
it's like trashier, but it's still good to me.
To return to this question of period settings and modern stories, I'm curious, after our discussion, do you guys feel the same way about them? Has your thinking on them changed? Like, what are they trying to do? I don't be like, what is the point of them? But we do have the spate of them, and they are clearly trying to do something beyond just get people to watch them. And how well do you think Dickinson in particular, compared with the others, succeeds?
I mean, what this conversation has, like, made me realize is just how kind of soulful the show is, this show in particular, but also, like, all of this class of them. Like, what's the point of adapting history to be a modern comedy versus, like, adapting history to be, like, a kind of pulpy Game of Thronesy, like, historical story about the past that teaches you about the past? Why do we need to turn to, like, a kind of delightful modern comedy? I mean, it's just, like, yeah, you get a sense of, like, what makes you a human. Like, it's really pretentious, but, like, that's, like, I think the point of Emily Dickinson's poetry, too. Like that is what they are doing. And another thing you could say is that it's bringing history alive.
Yes. Mm. Yes! I've also come to realize how much harder it is to do this form of remixing than, you know, just taking something historical and plopping it in modern day and, you know, turning a character into a girl boss, for instance.
I think
that's so much easier to do, and it's so much harder to quote Emily Dickinson, to tell all the truth, but tell it slant.
Yes, Shirley, you've given us a quote. I thought we'd have more. This is perfect. There is a certain slant of light behind you, Shelley, right now that I can see in our video, by the way. It's really...
Oh, yes. I can finally see it.
Winter afternoons.
But yeah, that's what I've gathered. This is really hard to do, to apply our modern sensibilities to history and then to truly derive a message from it. I don't know how long this trend will last in our... I was about to say post-Hamilton world. That doesn't feel right.
Well, with that in mind, for our closing round, if you had to pick a historical person to give the Dickinson treatment, who would you pick and why? Spencer, I'll start with you.
I was doing a YouTube rabbit hole this past weekend about medieval battles, and I learned a lot about Joan of Arc. And I know there have been many adaptations and stories about Joan of Arc's life, because she was totally, and this is not a word we should use, but she was batshit. But you know, commanded incredible loyalty from the people around her, and you know, changed the course of history by just being so batshit. And so I could see a sort of like VP style show that was about the people around Joan of Arc, like trying to understand this woman who was talking to God, and the various of them like dying in battle.
I love that. I would watch.
Yeah.
I would go a lot further back. I was thinking about what stories Hollywood hasn't adapted recently. I was thinking that we could go all the way back to like 55, 57 BC and retackle Ooh. Cleopatra with, you know, historically accurate casting, but completely modern sensibilities. Turn that story on its head. All the poison and backstabbing and palace intrigue and being rolled up in a carpet and...
Oh, being rolled up in a carpet, yeah. Yes. That's like Taylor Swift being put into like a guitar case or
oh my God, that's
luggage, right? Like, she's
Taylor
a celebrity,
in the suitcase.
Right?
Yeah. I think you could say a lot about celebrity with Cleopatra.
Well, I don't have a good idea, but Spencer's talking about Veep made me think maybe... I mean, I don't really want to do a disservice to anyone actually good and significant from history by giving them a kind of slightly wacky creative treatment. But I do think like maybe the young Margaret Thatcher, you know, you've got the girl boss vibes, like you said, Shirley, she, you know, is a problematic figure from the past who maybe would knit in an intriguing way with the problematic figures from the present. Nice. But I think I need to think this one through a bit more.
It'll come, I feel like. Yeah. Give Hollywood a few more decades.
It's true. Maybe we just need more time. And also, I'm still slightly scarred by Gillian Anderson's portrayal of her from The Crown. So.
Oh, my God. That voice.
Ugh. Emmy winning. Ugh.
It's the Dune voice.
Well, that does it for the show. The Review is produced by Kevin Townsend with help from AC Valdez. Our art is by Charlie Le Mignon. I'm Sophie Gilbert. Thank you, Shirley.
Thank you.
Thank you, Spencer.
Thank you.